Hi everyone, welcome. I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Tonight, I'm going to talk about pride. One of the cool things about this meeting is that sometimes we can go off book. So when we're in OA meetings, we're respectful of the traditions and don't mention other literature. But here, sometimes we might find something that we think is helpful and that kind of enhances what we want to talk about. So we bring it up. So pride. So we had just finished working on steps 4 through 7, talking about inventorying our defects, asking God to remove them. And so we did a workshop on forgiveness the other day, and now pride. Well, why pride? On page 62 of the big book, it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our troubles. So we want to get this up at the root. And then later on page 116, when it's talking to the wives, it says, "We wives found, like everybody else, we were afflicted with pride, self-pity, vanity, and all the things which go to make up the self-centered person." So numero uno at the list of what makes up a self-centered person is pride. And in the AA 12 and 12, on page 70, if anyone wants to go look at it after, they state that the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. Why? And they say, well, first of all, without humility, we can't stay sober, or for us, abstinent. But then the 12 and 12 goes on to say that that's not enough. That unless we develop much more of this precious quality than is required just to be sober or abstinent, we can't be happy, we can't be useful, and we can't summon the faith we need in order to be able to deal with adversity. So in other words, pride actually blocks faith. It makes sense, right? If I think that I'm so wonderful and above everyone else, I won't really be looking for God because I'll think I'm just fine. But we're going to talk about 11 or 12 different types of pride. And I know that I often have them all. So probably you'll be able to identify with at least one of them. And then at the end, I'll try and give some tips for ways to deal with it. So Sam Shoemaker, who was a spiritual advisor to Bill Wilson, in his book, If I Be Lifted Up, defined pride as a high esteem of oneself for some real or imaginary merit or superiority. A high esteem of oneself for some real or imaginary merit or superiority. So that's interesting, even if it's real. Right? If it's imaginary, we can all see that, right? Like if I think I'm smarter than Einstein, well, clearly that's not true. So that's ridiculous. But if I think, you know, I'm so great because I got into graduate school, well, I really did get into graduate school. But what they're saying is if I feel pride because of that, not self-esteem, which is just like healthy and it's good, but like I'm better than, or I dwell on it too much, that's prideful. So here's, I think I've got 11 or 12 different types of pride. The first one is caring what other people think, showing off, right? If I want other people to see what I have, like my gorgeous clothes, my cool car, I'm silently bragging. And this can manifest itself in the things we give our children, right? I remember, gosh, when my daughter was a little, maybe 2, and I was taking her to the chiropractor, and she was wearing the same outfit she had worn last time we went. And I demanded that she change. What was I trying to do? Impress the chiropractor that, you know, my daughter has this stellar wardrobe. So that's prideful. That was all about me. And then, a quote I love, this is from Timothy Keller. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next person. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good looking, but they're not. They're proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or clever or good looking, there'd be nothing to be proud about. Okay. The second, the flip side from caring what other people think can be not caring at all what other people think. Now, if I don't care for the right reasons because I'm just focused on what God thinks about me, that's fine. But according to C.S. Lewis, the diabolical pride comes when you look down on others so much that you don't care what they think of you. If you say, why should I care for the applause of that rabble as if their opinion were worth anything? Okay, form of pride. Number three, this one's a dagger in my heart, pride of affiliation. That can be pride in what my family has done, right? Either our ancestors, like my great-great-grandfather was on the Mayflower. But you know, we use things like that to make me special, or ones that I've done. When my son was a senior in high school, he was the goalie of the varsity soccer team. So if I said, my son is the goalie of the varsity soccer team, as if that made me special. I can't kick a soccer ball to save my life, but pride of affiliation. Or for me, I work for a company that does websites for like some major league sports teams and some pretty high end companies. So it used to be, I would mention what my company did and who our clients were, you know, because people say, wow, your client is whoever. They don't let me near building a website. I don't do any of that. I sit in the back office and I like do the books and things like that. But it's like pride of affiliation. When we have that kind of pride, we expect to be deferred to, not for any moral or intellectual distinction in ourselves, but because we're related to somebody notable. Number four, pride in our accomplishments, like pride in my IQ or something I've done. Again, it's okay to have self-esteem, but we should always recognize that everything we have is a gift from God. And then another quote I liked, success isn't measured by how well I'm doing compared to another person. It's measured by how well I'm doing compared to how well I'm supposed to be doing. Number five, spiritual pride. And Sam Shoemaker says that this is the deadliest form of pride. Maybe I'm bad, but I'm not as bad as so-and-so, right? Comparing ourselves and saying, yeah, I'm doing this, but so everyone's cheating on their taxes and I'm only cheating a little. I mean, during World War II, if you walked around France, everyone was emaciated. It was normal, but it wasn't healthy, right? So we don't, we can't have spiritual pride by just comparing ourselves to others and saying, well, you know, I may not be abstinent, but I'm only binging a little. They're binging a lot. Number six, pride of a spiritual influencer. So if a person only hears about how much he helps others, he can relapse into a pride strong enough to kill everything genuinely spiritual in his life. The best defense against this is sponsoring. That protects against it because inevitably, no matter how good a sponsor you are, there will always be failures that keep us humble. I've never known anyone who says, yep, I sponsored 100 people and all 100 of them got through the steps and didn't relapse and they're sponsoring other people. It doesn't happen, unfortunately. And really a way to even that we can work on deepening that is if a sponsee drops out or keeps struggling, instead of automatically saying, oh, she just wasn't willing. If we do an honest 10 step and say, did we have a part? Did we push too much? Did we not push enough? Did we not give them enough time? Now, ultimately, a person's recovery is 100% on them. But as a sponsor, if someone's struggling, I need to look and say, see, you know, could I have done a better job? Number seven, self-reliance. The big book says that we have fear because self-reliance has failed us. And self-reliance is thinking that I don't need God, that I can handle it myself. And here are some ways it might manifest. If we think, I can change my food plan and I don't need to discuss it with someone. I'll just make like this little tweak. Instead of having 4 ounces, I'm getting hungry. So I think I'll just start having 5 ounces. I mean, maybe you do need 5 ounces, but always we should, in this area particularly, we should discuss it with someone else and not just assume we can do it on our own. Other manifestations, if I don't make time to pray and meditate, or for me, if I don't meditate without pen and paper, because it means I'm either thinking God isn't going to show up, and then where's my step two? Or I'm thinking that what God has to say to me isn't important enough to write down to make sure I remember it correctly. When I was in my 20s, I had a boss who said to me, every time you come into my office, you should bring a pad and a pen. So if I'm going to do that when I go to see my employer, how much more so should I do it when I'm meeting with my employer with a capital E? And Timothy Keller had said, spiritual pride is the illusion that we are competent to run our own lives, achieve our own sense of self-worth, and find a purpose big enough to give us meaning in life without God. Number eight, jealousy. Well, jealousy is really a form of pride. It's really me telling God that the way he has distributed gifts is unfair. So I'm saying, God, you didn't do a good job when you decided she should have that and not me. So I remember, you know, there was a time I was trying to get pregnant and was having trouble, and a good friend of mine was pregnant, and she was afraid to tell me because she thought like it might arouse jealousy. Noble on her part, but I realized like God is infinite power and love. If he gives her a baby, that doesn't mean that he can't give me a baby. And, you know, even at work, if there's one person to get a promotion and someone else gets it, it's okay. God can provide for me in a different way. There can be jealousy that comes at thinking someone's doing a better job at something than I am. And the antidote for that, do something for the person we're jealous about. You know, we confess it to someone else, generally not that person, but to our sponsor or a trusted friend. And then we do something to help the person we're jealous of, to bring some more good into their life. We think their life has so much good. Let's go bring some more. Number nine, hypersensitivity. That's me telling people that the way they're talking to me is wrong. On page 125 of the big book, it says that we alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow that serious handicap. Now, none of us like being told that we're doing something wrong, especially for me by my kids. I remember, I have this written down, one time my son left his coffee in another room and it started getting mold in it. And I thought, oh, to teach him a lesson, I just quietly just put the cup in his room. And he just said to me, Mom, something like, Mom, you could have just asked me to put it in the sink. Now we can debate whether I did the right thing or not, but I have to bite my tongue and say, okay, maybe I could have done that. Now, I don't always, right? Sometimes we hold our boundaries, especially with our kids, but we have to be very careful to feel that we've come so far that nobody can tell us that we've done anything wrong. Also, we want to be careful, because by doing this, it's really a subtle form of manipulation. I know sometimes if I have sponsees who get like very hypersensitive at the least bit of criticism, then I find myself not wanting to point things out to them, which is doing them a disservice. So I have to fight against that inclination and realize, like, you know, when people are hypersensitive, what they're really saying is, okay, here's how you can talk to me. You know, it's a way of trying to control how people can talk to us, and in a way that we can enjoy it and not feel uncomfortable. Unfortunately, often all forms of growth require some kind of discomfort. Number 10, unforgiveness. Unforgiveness is me forgetting how much God has forgiven me and thinking I'm entitled to a life where everything goes my way, or at the very least is fair. But to quote another famous person, Melissa C here, I'm now in the world of the spirit. Fairness is not my code. Love and tolerance is. So again, if I'm not forgiving, I'm saying someone was unfair. It's okay. Now, I might have to set boundaries. You know, I don't need to be abused, but everything doesn't need to be fair. I just need to be loving, and I just need to be tolerant. So if our kids, you know, I used to have a problem with one of my kids, if he would raise his voice at me and I would get angry, and I would realize I can discipline, but still forgive. My lack of forgiveness was my pride. How dare he talk to me that way? I mean, he was a teenager. That's what teenagers do sometimes. And what moms do, or what I tried to do, is set appropriate boundaries. Like, you know, if you talk to me that way, you may not, I don't know, get the car keys or something. But I have to forgive. Number 11, entitlement. To feel that I'm entitled to anything. I had a former sponsor who was a recovered alcoholic, and he told about how when he first started getting sober, and he had been literally like Skid Row, his hands were shaking so much at AA meetings that they would just give him 2 half cups of coffee because he couldn't, you know, he would just splash a full cup over. And his mom would change his bed sheets, I think daily, because he just sweat right through them at night. And he said, if this is as good as it gets, it's good enough. If this is as good as it gets, it's good enough. So if it's the summer and I feel entitled, like, you know, come hell or high water, I am going to go in my backyard and spend time in my swimming pool. No, I'm not entitled to that. God may have other things for me to do that day. To think, you know, I'm just not entitled to very much. The 12th thing is criticizing. Criticizing is always thinking that I'm better, that if I were in that situation, I would do a better job. And in the AA 12 and 12 on page 67, it says that gossip, barbed with our anger, is a polite form of murder by character assassination. Here, we're not trying to help those we criticize. We're trying to proclaim our own righteousness. So that's kind of what I saw about pride. So how do we get over it, right? So we see it, well, at least I see it in myself. So what do we do? Well, here's something we don't do. We don't tell ourselves that I'm really not fill in the blank, not that smart, not that pretty, not that helpful. And this is a great quote from C.S. Lewis from his book, The Screwtape Letters. By this method, thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means pretty women trying to believe that they are ugly, and clever men trying to believe that they are fools. And since what they're trying to believe may in some cases be manifest nonsense, they cannot succeed in believing it, and their minds are endlessly revolving on themselves. So here's the antidotes. One, thinking about others, right? This is from Timothy Keller. The thing we would remember from meeting a truly humble person is how much they seem to be totally interested in us. Because the essence of humility is not thinking more of myself or less of myself. It's thinking of myself less, right? And then C.S. Lewis goes on to say, if you meet a really humble person, probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. So, and again, the big book says on page 70, when it's talking about sex, and remember we treat sex problems as we do any other problems, says, if it's troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. That takes us out of ourselves. So what we can do is think of the others who are in our sphere, in our family, you know, our friends, our recovery groups. What need do they have? Now, again, needs and wants aren't always the same, especially with our kids. You know, their wants is going to be to have like dessert for dinner all the time, right? But that's not their needs. But to think of the people that we know, what are their needs? And how can I fill that need? And if we really want to like work on it, we try to do it anonymously. Like, go clean your husband's sock drawer. He probably won't notice, but it's, you know, something that's needed, not a huge need probably, but a need, and it's anonymous. I used to tell my sponsees that something they have to do is every day do three things for someone else, and two of them have to be anonymous. Because if we're using our brains, thinking about other people, and that's pretty hard every day to find like two anonymous things to do for someone else. If I'm thinking about that, I'm not thinking about myself. And it's not so much a question of, I purposely didn't say I'm not thinking about food. Because if I'm thinking about others and thinking about God and working for the welfare of others and working to deepen my relationship with God, the obsession with food will automatically disappear. I can't make myself not think of food, but I can think about others, work for others, take action, work to get closer to God. The second thing is to really realize that I have pride. C.S. Lewis said, to acquire humility, the first step is to realize that one is proud. At least nothing whatever can be done before that. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed. So love that one. So, you know, we realize that we have pride and we look to see, and then we can do an inventory on it. We can do the steps on it. We can look at the manifestations of pride, admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another person, ask God to remove it, make amends, and then best we can try to practice the opposite. How do we practice the opposite? Here's a couple ideas. I mentioned before, if I'm jealous, I do something for the person I'm jealous of. If I realize I want to be noticed for wearing the nicest clothes, I make a point of wearing ordinary clothes. Right before I started graduate school, I had a talk with a friend of mine, you know, because I was concerned about pride and, you know, what if I want like show off, like I'm the smartest one in the class. And she said, just raise your hand once per class. Now, again, that might not be advice for everyone, especially for someone who's shy, but for someone, you know, like me, who has a tendency to fall off the bed on the other side, to discipline myself that I'm only going to raise my hand once per class was a way to combat pride. The third thing we can do is practice gratitude. Sam Shoemaker says that the antidote for pride is not humility, but gratitude. Humility is still struggling with one's own attitude. Gratitude has found something without, in the presence of which to forget oneself and bow down in thankfulness. Pride may hide unseen in humility, but not in thankfulness. And the thankfulness should not be what God has done through me, because then I may still be marveling at myself. I should be marveling at what God has done for me, right? Because if I say, oh, look at what God does through me, you know, I speak and with his words and I'm helping all these people. No, there's too much self in there, too much pride. But if I marvel at what God has done for me, he's removed my food obsession. He's restored relationship with family members. I don't get credit for that. That's God. So a lot of us have an app, My Spiritual Toolkit or My Toolkit, that has a section for gratitude where we can list gratitudes, or we'll just text a few gratitudes to people every day. I say that's fine, but it needs to go further, because we want to be grateful to God. So when I type up my gratitude list, when I'm done, I go and I thank God, like, dear God, thank you that, you know, I have heat in my house in the cold weather. Thank you, God, that, you know, I have a husband who's supportive of my 12-step work. Thank you, God, for like a renewed relationship with my children. Remember, we don't just stop with the list. God wants to communicate with us, to have a relationship with us. And, you know, part of our relationship should always be gratitude. And that's a way to cultivate humility. And the fourth is prayer. There's something, I don't have the words here, but it's, you can Google it. It's called the Litany of Humility. So it's a Christian prayer. So if you're not a Christian, probably wouldn't want that one, but that's a nice one. And then here's another one that I read recently that I really liked. Lord, please do whatever it takes to diminish pride's power in my life. I still covet glory and honor, but I know I should serve without thought of getting credit. So hard. Make your selfless love for me so palpable and affecting that I don't care what others think. Lord, even as I pray for humility, I am prideful. All I can say is, Lord, be merciful to me. Trisha, go ahead and put that in the chat. So we can pray. And I think a final thing is, if we really realize how much we are loved by God, the times when I can soak myself in it, then those are the times when it's easier to say, it doesn't matter what he does to me. It doesn't matter what she thinks about me. I am loved by God. I know that God has my back. So it doesn't really matter other people's opinions. So again, to just realize how beloved we are by God. And that comes through prayer and meditation. And I'm going to close by reading a story. I've read this before, about a person who, to me, just exemplifies humility. So it is from the book, How to Pray, A Simple Guide for Normal People. Dominique, a lean, muscular 6'2", always wearing a navy blue beret, was a monk and learned at age 54 that he was dying of inoperable cancer. With the community's permission, he moved to a poor neighborhood in Paris and took a job as night watchman at a factory. Returning home every morning at 8 a.m., he would go directly to a little park across the street from where he lived and sit down on a wooden bench. Hanging around the park were marginal people, drifters, winos, has-beens, dirty old men who ogled the girls passing by. Dominique never criticized, scolded, or reprimanded them. He laughed, told stories, shared his candy, accepted them just as they were. From living so long out of the inner sanctuary, he gave off a peace, a serene sense of self-possession and hospitality of heart that caused cynical young men and defeated old men to gravitate toward him like bacon toward eggs. His simple witness lay in accepting others as they were without question and allowing them to make themselves at home in his heart. Dominique was the most non-judgmental person I have ever known. He loved with the heart of God. One day when the ragtag group of rejects asked him to talk about himself, Dominique gave them a thumbnail description of his life. Then he told them with quiet conviction that God loved them tenderly and stubbornly, that God came for rejects and outcasts just like them. His witness was credible because the word was enfleshed on his bones. Later, an old timer said, the dirty jokes, the vulgar language, and the leering at girls just stopped. One morning, Dominique failed to appear on his park bench. The men grew concerned. A few hours later, he was found dead on the floor of his cold water flat. He died in the obscurity of a Parisian slum. Dominique never tried to impress anybody, never wondered if his life was useful or his witness meaningful. He never felt he had to do something great for God. He did keep a journal. It was found shortly after his death in the drawer of the nightstand by his bed. His last entry is one of the most astonishing things I have ever read. And this is what it said. All that is not the love of God has no meaning for me. I can truthfully say that I have no interest in anything but the love of God. If God wants it to, my life will be useful through my word and witness. If he wants it to, my life will bear fruit through my prayers and sacrifices. But the usefulness of my life is God's concern, not mine. It would be indecent of me to worry about it. And I try to think about that when we sponsor others or when we serve or when, you know, all of this, we do it out of our obedience and our ultimately our love for God. It starts out, we do it just out of obedience, but we want it to grow quickly into love, knowing we're loved by him. And then that just makes us automatically want to reciprocate and love him. And so when we sponsor or we do something like, yes, we want people to recover because, you know, we want people to just like share in this great joy. But ultimately, that's not my job to, you know, get X number of people through the steps. My job is to be obedient to God. And whether or not it bears fruit, ultimately, is none of my business. And with that, I pass.